morning, ladies and gentlemen. Today is Monday, Wednesday, May 31st, 2017, and I'm opening a meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. Today we will be doing a public hearing and work session, which I'm opening both of them now. I'm opening both public hearing and work session. We had a little confusion yesterday. On Senate Bill 5543, the rebalance bill for the Departments of Human Services and the Oregon Health Authority. Ms. Ames, kick us off here, please.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, today we will hear from both Department of Human Services and Oregon Health Authority on the rebalance plan. This is hopefully the last time that they will be here talking to us about closing out the current biennium. So there's some savings, there's costs, there's revenue changes. We are able to move money between appropriations, and then that should get them out of the biennium, although we always have one last chance in the fall if we have to revisit that issue. And in terms of the process, so DHS will present on their rebalance plan, OHA will present, and then we will have an opportunity for public testimony. And then as time allows, the agencies have each brought some information about what the caseloads look like for 17-19.
And then at the end of today, just a reminder, we will also be having an informational meeting. Right. All right, cool. Mr. Psyche, Mr. Moore, whoever's here, come on up. Start your human service.
So, Chair Steiner Hayward, Chair Rayfield, for the record, Clyde Psyche, Department of Human Services. And we're here today to present on our rebalance. So let's just jump right into it, Eric, on slide number one. So the bottom line for us is that we are not here requesting any additional general fund, and we also are anticipating an additional general fund that we could revert or use for other purposes to the tune of $51.4 million. I would just caution that we still have some risks associated with expenditures that could come in after the end of the biennium or caseload issues, but at this point in time, with the best information we have, this is what we're anticipating. So the major savings drivers since the last time we talked to you in since the December of 2016 rebalance, caseload cost per savings in our aging and people with disabilities division, savings in the employment-related daycare program, and in our temporary assistance to needy families. We also, when I initially came in November of 2016, was informed that at that point in time, we were projecting about an $85 million general fund deficit. They didn't tell me that before I agreed to come over to the department. They didn't tell me that until I got there. But really met with our leadership team and said, you know, it's our responsibility to balance the budget. And so had them put together plans to get us to a balanced budget. So some of the things that led to the savings, like I said, there were savings in the three programs that I mentioned up above. We had some savings in personal services, additional one-time revenue or increase in state recoveries, and we also were able to leverage more federal funds in several of our programs. So really, at a very high level, this chart shows you where the savings came from and the amount of the savings by each of the program areas. And so again, no general fund requests. We could revert or disappropriate or unschedule $51.4 million of general fund. We are going to have a request to increase some of our federal fund and other fund limitations. And so with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Moore, and he will walk you through each of the program areas.
Co-chairs Steiner, Hayward, and Rayfield, members of the committee, my name is Eric Moore, the CFO for DHS, for the record. We'll head right into the aging and people with disabilities. There's a net savings of about $17.5 million general fund. APD, or Aging and People with Disabilities, has taken actions based on previous decisions to limit the live-in program that have exceeded expectations and led to additional savings in the in-home program of about $12 million general fund. This is the net impact to the live-in savings and primarily costs in the hourly program. APD has also had more ACA-eligible clients, which are 100% federal fund, federally funded clients, than anticipated. An increase in the amount of targeted case management service, which is a service that gets a higher rate of match from the federal government. About $5.5 million of unexpected estate recoveries that have helped us read savings into this budget. Finally, some hiring strategies led to more savings than initially anticipated in the budget when those hiring strategies were developed. In the Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities Program, while there's been a slight increase in caseload from the last rebalance, the people with intellectual and developmental disabilities programs have a net savings of $3 million of general fund. This is primarily due to negotiation of a better match rate for the management and administrative employees at the Stabilization and Crisis Unit, or SACU, and hiring delays due to prolonged bargaining. However, DHS proposes in this rebalance to retain these savings to offset any further increases in caseload or cost per case or other anticipated costs that come in after the close of the biennium. Any unused funds would revert during the normal process of reversion at the end of the calendar year. Child welfare has a net savings of about $11.8 million. While there are overages in Attorney General spending due to both giving up inflation in prior biennia and increase in usage, this is offset by savings in safety and permanency programs. Of note is the applicable child savings, which are generated due to federal law that has increased the number of children eligible for federal funding. However, the federal funds savings by federal law also requires that the funds be reinvested or supplement, not supplant, into the child welfare system to avoid penalties equivalent to the savings generated. DHS has proposed Senate Bill 102 this session that would allow DHS to put these general fund savings into an, quote, other funds account to allow them both to be tracked and carried over into future biennia for use as federal law allows. So far, DHS has estimated $5.5 million in savings that at some point must be reinvested into the child welfare system, with 30% going to post-adoption services by federal mandate. Savings are anticipated to rise to over $6 million in additional savings in 2017-19. Child welfare savings is also driven by underspending general fund and child welfare, but spending the same amount of general fund in the self-sufficiency programs. In return, TANF federal fund is spent in child welfare instead of TANF program to allow general fund to be counted as maintenance of effort. This is a little bit of a confusing technical adjustment. In effect, we spend child welfare general fund in TANF in order to count it as maintenance of effort, because you can do that, but you can't spend general fund in child welfare and count it as maintenance of effort for TANF. So we spend some of allowable TANF in the child welfare program in place of the general fund. So it's a net zero action for the appropriation and for the agency. It's just where we're spending the money in order to count it for maintenance of effort for TANF purposes. DHS is also proposing to keep $1 million of general fund in this appropriation for child welfare for unanticipated costs that come in after the close of the biennium. In self-sufficiency, self-sufficiency is realizing significant savings in the TANF program. It's a little bit larger than it would normally be because we did not realize TANF savings at the last rebalance. So this number of $30.2 million of general fund is the actual general fund savings in the TANF program. In addition, due to unanticipated lower utilization of the ERDC program and a reduction in eligible providers, there's about $11.2 million in general fund savings anticipated for the ERDC program. Again, as mentioned in the child welfare section, we have this technical adjustment where we're doing general fund swap for TANF, which causes a problem here that's offset by the larger amount of savings. So we have a net savings in the self-sufficiency programs as well.
Yeah, sorry, Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Co-Chair. On the TANF savings, would you describe to us how the Social Security insurance benefit is being counted differently? And does that account for some of these savings as countable funds?
Co-chairs, Representative Hayden, I don't believe at this time we are counting SSI in the eligibility for TANF, so it would not have impacted the TANF caseload.
But your forecast budget has that consideration in it, correct?
I believe the co-chair's framework has some counting of SSI in eligibility.
So you're having this savings in the TANF program without considering those funds as countable?
That's true. Between enhanced case management to try to get people into jobs and the improving economy, that the caseload has been dropping significantly.
Follow up?
Sure.
So then why would it be necessary to draw Social Security benefits in as a countable benefit?
Co-chairs, Representative Hayden, I'm not sure that there is an easy answer to that question.
And
this
we can
is
probably
one of the,
answer
the
it
larger.
Why don't we help
Why
don't we help you?
We were so as a you know as a framework, we were given without new revenue with the projections existing as in January with the revenue, we were given a task to find $285 million to balance the budget. In doing so, this was one of the various options as we tried to, in an even-handed way, the co-chair and myself try to look at all the various options to reduce to $285 million of savings to balance the budget because we had to operate as though no new revenue was coming in. These are not actions taken by DHS. Rather, these are things that we looked at as if we are going to cut $285 million, also understanding there's a whole bunch of match money and the community impact is a heck of a lot greater than $285 million. These were the strategies of least impact that we felt that we could get down to the number of $285 million to come out with the framework. So that has nothing to do with DHS in terms of what they did is they put together a list of various options which we explored with them in terms of impact.
And so. Furthermore, many of those options, given the lower caseload already extant, many of those options may have to be repriced, and therefore we're continuously in the process, you know, with these new caseload numbers, we're continuously repricing, working with the agency to reprice those options and figure out what our budgets really look like. So it's kind of a moving target at this point.
Yeah. Fair enough, but for the record, I'm concerned about that particular aspect.
I will just put on the record right here and right now that my co-chair and I are massively unhappy about pretty much every single cut we have to make. So if anybody has any question about that, based on everything you've heard in this room for the past 4 months, don't.
And just one more follow-up, Madam Chair. And I think I would put a fine point on this in our budget. There are going to be cuts we're going to have to make without revenue in going forward. And I think, you know, as I continue to talk to different members and colleagues, I think the vision of Oregon that we have does not match the amount of revenue that comes into this state. And I can say that pretty confidently with talking with many Republicans and many Democrats. Of course, there are going to be some people who do not agree with that statement. But as we go through this, I would start creating a list of all the things that you want added back and put that together into the conversation of how do we as a state match our revenue with the vision of what we want Oregon to look like. And I think that's the process that we're engaging right now.
Thank you. Okay. Good. Mr. Moore.
The final place that we have issues or savings at this point in the budget is in our statewide assessment and enterprise-wide costs. It's a slight savings of $1.7 million of general fund. This is primarily driven by a facility project that could not be completed in 2015-17, and in shared services funding, which primarily, due to cost allocation changes, moves some of the costs to OHA. Usage of shared services by DHS was also slightly over projected in 2015-17. In summary, again, there are still risks to the DHS budget, and DHS has proposed to keep some buffer in these numbers in specific appropriations to help avoid having that closeout rebalance that Ms. Ames mentioned at the beginning of the hearing. We ask for those additional buffers because there's inevitably increases in something that happen for caseload or cost per case by the end of the biennium. And also we get invoices that come in after the close of the biennium that we also have to pay out of the 15-17 budget. And so this is a hedge on what we think are going to come in after the end of the biennium. So with that, are there we'll take any
questions. Further questions for Mr. Moore or Mr. Seifert? Thank you, gentlemen.
Yeah.
Appreciate it. Ms. Saxton, Ms. Evans, I believe you're up.
Get it out. Good morning, co-chairs. I'm Lynn Saxton, director of the Oregon Health Authority, and we're here today to outline our rebalance for this biennium, as well as talk about the forecast, the spring forecast. I want to introduce our budget director, Janelle Evans, who has, many of you knew Bill Coulomb, who was our esteemed budget director for many years, and Janelle has done an exceptional job of filling large shoes and leading us through this challenging budget year. So I'm going to turn it over to Janelle, and we're happy to answer any questions you have.
Good morning. I'm Janelle Evans, budget director for the Oregon Health Authority. Thank you for this opportunity to present our hopefully our final rebalance for 2015-17. This first slide, let me get it up here. The first slide here is a high-level look at the answer before we go into more detail. Our total challenges are $22 million general funds with a total savings of 29.6 for a net savings of 7.6 million general funds. This next slide will dive into more details, starting with the challenges. The first one is $5.9 million general fund issue related to our Part D drugs for our dual eligibles. This is what we're charged. It's called a clawback. The federal government charges us, the general funds, to support the drug costs for the dual eligibles. And on the first of the year, the federal rate went up by over 10%, causing an issue here. The next one is OHA has spent $4.8 million in 2015-17 on legal fees related to the Oracle lawsuit. And the last challenge listed here is in our assessments and enterprise-wide costs. Most of this is due to cost allocation issues. This biennium, we've included the state hospital, which is mostly general funded, in our statistics, and that is driving a much greater fund general fund need. The savings include drug rebate revenue. We're about $6 million over our original projection for the biennium. The tobacco tax forecast is higher than the previous forecast and projecting a $5 million general fund savings. The spring caseload forecast has a small projected savings of $3.6 million, and I have more slides on that coming up next. We also have some program updates. So the largest part is what we refer to as SNRG. This is our special needs rate group. In 2012, OHA moved this high-risk population and services into from fee-for-service to CCOs with a risk corridor. The final settlement this year has produced general fund savings to OHA of $5.3 million. The next part, the largest part of the program savings, is in our Care Assist budget in public health. Care Assist helps people living with HIV and AIDS to pay for their medical care. They also collect drug rebates for this group, and those have been higher than anticipated, and we've been able to use those drug rebate revenues in lieu of the general funds. So there's a $3 million general fund savings. We also have some administrative savings of $4 million, and we are asking to remove our excess federal fund limitation, which we haven't been previously able to remove from the budget at e-boards. This is a high-level look at our spring caseload forecast for the OHP Medicaid caseload. This compares the spring 2017 forecast with the fall 16 forecast, and overall has a change of 0.3%. This slide has more details on the caseload changes, costs per eligibility group. I just wanted to highlight a few. The ACA adults on the first line is down 1%. The parent caretaker relative up to
Ms. Evans?
Yes.
Sorry, just out of curiosity, I know that one of the things that's happened during redetermination is that some people have been determined to actually be pre-ACA eligible, categorically eligible, when in fact they only enrolled through ACA. Mm-hmm. That 4,100, do we have any idea how many of those went from coming off of the ACA onto categorical, or are they all just off of OHP entirely?
So we have co-chair Steiner Hayward, thank you. We could probably break it down for you further.
I was just curious if you know. It's not critically important, but obviously if they go off entirely, it's a true savings. If they move over, it's actually a net cost.
There's always some of both.
So I'm just curious about
it's both.
It's both, mm-hmm. Right. I mean, I figured it was both. I was just wondering about the breakdown. But it's not urgent. If you get a chance to get it back to us, great. If not, don't worry about it.
Okay. I wanted to highlight the Children's Medicaid line. That's down 1.1%, 3,800. But if you'll notice a few more lines further down is the Children's Health Insurance Program. So that's almost 3,600 up from the previous forecast on average. Those two populations are the same age group of children. They're just in different federal poverty levels. So this all leads to a total savings of $25.5 million. And for these populations, that breaks down to $9.5 million in general funds, accounting for the unfunded portion at the December e-board of $6 million, that's a net savings of $3.6 million. Just quickly going over the budget risks outlined, our major budget risks are for our caseload, revenue, rate setting, and then new treatment costs that are on the horizon.
Questions for Ms. Evans or Ms. Saxton?
Thank you for this. Again, this is kind of follow-up to what we had not too long ago. Mm-hmm. On and a couple of questions that I asked at that prior committee hearing on redetermination was a comparison between the funds spent on fee-for-service. We're all aware that fee-for-service caseloads has somewhere north of 150,000 caseloads, I think, at this point, unless that's adjusted since the last time I was given numbers on it. I had asked for a comparison between the cost of taking care of those caseloads on fee-for-service versus the cost if they were in a CCO. And I did get a response on it, but the response was we don't track that. And it would take an extended period of time to get that type of data. It seems pretty basic and important information to know whether your fee-for-service caseloads, if you have 150,000 members there, whether that's an efficient way to take care of it. So what is the technical glitch that you can't compare what it costs for fee-for-service members to be taken care of on a fee-for-service type basis versus what it costs in a CCO in the SNERDS program? You're showing $11 million benefit by putting that population into fee-for-service. Hopefully, and I believe that they're actually probably also getting more access to care. Hopefully that's better too, but access to care is incredibly important. So on a small population or relatively small population, I don't know how many caseloads that is, but that seems to be a significant indicator that we might be able to do this in other areas. So I got the email back that says, we don't know. We don't compare those two. Seems like pretty basic accounting. Why don't we have that information?
Do you want me to answer that?
Sure.
Co-chairs, I want to say, first of all, it seems like really critical information, given that we're working hard to get more people into coordinated care organizations. I don't know if there is a financial barrier that has prevented us from getting that in the past. My staff will certainly tell me if there is, but we're going to have to do that analysis, even if we're not doing it now, because we are actively working with tribes and others to encourage them to get into a more managed care environment to save the state funds. So we can go back. I'll go back and talk to our team, both our health systems team and our finance team, because even if we can't do if there's some technical barrier to doing a detailed analysis of that, we can take there's a way to do that analysis by taking a subset of the populations and comparing them. And so the fact that we haven't done that or aren't currently doing that doesn't mean we can't, and we should, and we will need to. The discussion about particularly one of the pressures that will require us to do that is this fee-for-service rates being different in some spaces than the Medicaid rates for providers. The fee-for-service providers are intent on us being sure that our rates are the same for the same service across the state. We had a detailed work session on that yesterday, so we can fold this into that work.
I would just comment. I know, Senator Rose, you have a quick question, but I would just comment that part of the challenge, if I understand this whole issue well enough based on the excellent conversations that I've had with some of your team, Ms. Saxton, is that part of the fee-for-service population is very transient. A significant percentage of them are only on fee-for-service for a month or two as part of the redetermination process, and it's a retroactive redetermination. So what you really need to look at when you're looking at these numbers is people who are on fee-for-service for an extended period of time, as opposed to people who are on fee-for-service for a month or two as part of the redetermination process. So looking at the entire number isn't particularly useful. Looking at the number of people, looking at the costs for people who are on it on a prolonged basis, for one reason or another, Historically, dual eligibles have been opt in to CCOs. We're transitioning them to opt out, which is great. Our tribal members have a choice of being are opt in unless their tribe has specifically made an agreement to be in. There are a lot of variables that go into understanding this fee-for-service population because it's actually a very heterogeneous population, and it's hard to make assumptions. But as you quite rightly pointed out, we did see that by transitioning the SNRP folks over, we saw a significant cost savings in a fairly small population. So, Senator?
Just a quick request, not a question, and that is on the fee-for-service population, when you do the analysis, could you provide us also with the distribution across the state, where really is the, whether it's transit, but where we have a better understanding of the 36 counties where they exist? And I'm quite sure that you can break those down to the counties.
Yeah. So, co-chairs, let me just ask, is your question whether we'll be able to identify the fee-for-service down to the county level?
Yes.
And the answer is yes.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Other questions? Thank you both very much.
I would interrupt, Madam Chair, to say the agency is working on a new KPM that will measure this numbers on fee-for-service versus CCOs. Mm-hmm. So it'll be a little, we'll be tracking it and keeping track of it a little better.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about that at the regular budget work session.
Right. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
And as we're transitioning into public testimony, which we'll do in just a moment, I just want to point out and give my thanks to both Ms. Saxon and Mr. Psyche and their teams for working so hard to, in Mr. Psyche's case, turn an $85 million shortfall into a $51 million reversion, which is a pretty impressive turnaround in a mere 7 months. And so that's significant. And Ms. Saxon and your team, the work that you guys are doing in helping people get on into CCOs, looking aggressively at which populations would benefit most from that transition, things like that, that are contributing to your savings, is really important for the long-term well-being of Oregonians and for obviously for a budget. So I think it's impressive to see agency directors really taking initiative and empowering their teams to do work like this. So thank you both very much. Public testimony, Mr. Mullen, Ms. Heim are the only two signed up. Come on up.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee. For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. appreciate the opportunity to testify on a rebalance plan. It doesn't come always to be the case over the years. For those of you who are looking for a historical reference, I think only Senator Winters will remember these used to be called deviation plans, and the director of DHS found this to be a sort of unsavory term, and so we invented the idea of rebalance. But the focus on rebalance is really important, and it's, I think, important to recognize that with these large budgets to come within really a very small margin of the budget actually balancing to the dollar is a pretty amazing testimony to people that do this work year in and year out. As advocates, you know, we sometimes are critical of agencies, but we really want to see the agencies succeed because we're concerned about the services that people need. So as we look forward to what is going to be coming after this, we'll have the reshoot looking into the next biennium about how the budgets will work out. But to focus on the rebalance for a moment, the idea about having a reversion on the part of DHS is one that's interesting and important, and it's my hope that the reversion will be earmarked to help balance the budget in the next biennium. We know that you're facing that $285 million concern as far as the Department of Human Services is concerned. I want to point out a couple of other things very quickly. About the TANF program, we've been on a long march with the discussion about TANF, about going back to 2007 when we created elements that created our program in the state of Oregon, ran into a recession, made a decision really to emphasize keeping the grant levels intact and doing away with services until the economy improved, and then emphasizing services and having people get back into the workforce. The caseload drop there has really I think underscored the importance of that policy. In other words, people are getting back to work. We have caseload savings. You all passed House Bill 3535 in the 2015 session, which reinvests those savings back in with the population. I want to express some concern about the ERDC amount that's left. We all know that child care is a major issue. We have some instances where Madam Co-Chair, you worked on an issue relating to the earned income tax credit where sometimes people don't get the information. Sometimes public agencies have a hard time with finding the fine line about doing outreach and getting the word out into the community, so I don't know what's at stake there. I'm concerned also about the loss of the live-in program over a period of time. I understand the complications and the cost and the wage and hour issues, but when ORS 410 was envisioned way back in the 81 session, it was the idea about independence, dignity, and choice, and people being able to live as independently as possible. So I just want to sum up by saying that I think the rebalance is generally good news. There are some question marks here and there. And I think the biggest question mark of all is how we take the rebalance, hopefully reinvest those savings, and then look at a reasonable reshoot for 2017-19. And that will be the challenge that this subcommittee will have about putting a budget together, as well as the entire legislature about making sure that the revenue and the expenditures match up. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. And before Ms. Heim, you start, I just want to comment on two things you said, Mr. Mullen. The first is I share your concerns about ERDC, and it is a big challenge. When we advertise it too broadly, people get on a wait list, and they're there forever, and they're frustrated and disappointed. And when we don't advertise it enough, we end up underutilizing it. And it's a very challenging line to walk, as you pointed out. With regard to your concern about the live-in program, I would point out that our conversations with Ms. Carson Cottingham, and I'd be interested to know if you're hearing differently, is that the vast majority of people who have transitioned off of it are still at home. They're just at home with more caretakers than they had, caregivers than they had before. And that has been a jarring change for some people. But overall, my sense from talking to her and from her outreach to people is that overall it's been actually a positive change for a lot of people, that they've appreciated the variety, that there's been some getting people out of ruts and more actively engaged in different ways. So we were all anxious about this when the federal ruling came down that led us to have to make this change. But overall, we were looking at having to cut it entirely in the next biennium at a cost savings of $20 million. Now, because it's been much easier to transition people off than we anticipated, we're looking at if we cut it, it's a cost savings, I think it's now priced at $4 million. I mean, it's really significantly, it's surprising to all of us, I think, how easily that transition has gone. So we appreciate your concern, but I want to reassure you and those listening that it has not been an issue of transitioning people out of their homes into some kind of a group living situation, simply a matter of changing how their care is managed in their home. So just want to put that on the record. Ms. Heim.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the subcommittee. My name is Nan Heim, and I represent the Oregon Resource Association. Our members are 65 nonprofit programs throughout the state that provide employment and housing services to thousands of Oregonians experiencing intellectual and developmental disabilities. When I saw the $55 million savings in the DHS budget this morning, I felt I had to say something as you look at the reshoot. Our programs, as I think most of you know, are truly, truly in a crisis. I have represented this association for 30 years. One wonders, looking at the way things are, how they possibly could keep me. But the fact is that this year, for the first time, these programs are having to turn away individuals that they would like to serve because they cannot find staff to do the work to take care of them. This is truly, truly a crisis. Last session, we did get from this subcommittee and the legislature a 4% increase to take us from an average wage of $10.80 for the direct support professionals to $11.23. It is not enough. We asked for $20 million to try to get that wage above $12. If we had gotten it, we would still be a problem, but not the crisis that we are now. We are now asking for $45 million. It sounds like a lot, but given the crisis, it is not. I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Senator Winters.
I just have to put this on the record since Mr. Mullen made the comment. The two individuals who are testifying probably have been here as long as I have.
And we value all of your chronologic advantages and your wisdom that you've gained over the years. I can assure you that I have learned much from all three of you in my relatively short tenure here. Okay. Good. Anything else for this panel? Thank you both very, very much.
We are still at a work session.
Right. Ms. Ames has recommendations.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, a couple comments before we actually move the bill. The OHA plan showed a general fund savings of $7.6 million. I just wanted to point out that in the final recommendation, that's 11.6. There was an additional savings of $4 million in the Rural Provider Insurance Subsidy Program, where it's simply being underspent, and it was just a timing issue that it wasn't actually included in the official letter. The second thing is there's been some discussion about reversion of general fund versus actually removing it from the budget with the bill, and I just want everyone to be clear, this bill will actually take the general fund out of the budget.
Right.
Reversion, we would wait till December to see where everything was, and then it would just go back into the general fund. This is a little easier for planning because you have a specific number that you know about. On the other hand, it's a little higher risk for the agencies because they don't have that general fund now in case something gets goofy.
Okay.
So there is an amendment, the Dash 1 amendment, that makes all these adjustments. The bill itself is a blank budget bill, so it just had really couple of boilerplate things in it. So the Dash 1 amendment puts the budget adjustments into the bill.
Right. Thank you.
And with that, Madam Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 5543.
Thank you. Co-Chair Rayfield moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 5543. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? If not, so moved.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 5543 to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation as amended.
Thank you. Co-Chair Rayfield moves Senate Bill 5543 as amended to the full Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Hayden.
Just briefly, I'm hoping that the full Committee on Ways and Means can get some of the numbers that we talked about here so that they can look at that and make sure that that matches up as this comes through in a final form.
Representative Hayden, I appreciate your concern, but generally speaking, that's not what we do in full. I mean, these numbers, the agency will, I am sure, provide these answers for us, and they'll be lit up in OLIS for any member or any member of the public, for that matter, to look at. But we don't often have that detailed and about. We could. Yes, we could. Okay. Further discussion? Any opposition to the motion? Okay. If not, so moved. You want to take it in full? Winters. Okay. Senator Winters to full.
Easy.
Yeah, Senator Winters to full. End of the Senate floor, Senator. Okay. House Representative to take it to the floor. Representative Malmstrom, thank you very much. Okay, with that, I'm closing the public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 5543. Do I actually open an informational meeting?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
I'm opening an informational meeting on the Department of Human Services and the Oregon Health Authority 2017-19 caseload changes.
We'll start again with Mr. Saiki and Mr. Moore. Gentlemen, welcome back.
Thank you, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, and members of the committee. For the record, Clyde Saiki, Department of Human Services, and with Eric Moore, our Chief Financial Officer. And I am going to turn this presentation over to Mr. Moore, who is eminently more qualified to speak on this issue than I am.
Sure about that. Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Eric Moore, the Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Human Services. And I'll jump right into the adults and people with disabilities forecast. Caseload increases are in general being driven by the CAPE plan implementation, an aging demographic, the expansion of Medicaid and policy and program changes that intended to promote the use of in-home care rather than more expensive forms of service. The recent trend in nursing facility caseload is a bit troubling, but it is anticipated that actuals will drop in 17-19, and though starting at a higher caseload, it is still projected to reduce into the future. Growth in the people with intellectual or developmental disabilities program is again primarily due to implementation of the Community First Choice Option, or CAPE plan, which allows individuals eligible for the Oregon Health Plan to receive in-home services if they have extended need for assistance with activities of daily living. We've set out three of the major caseloads out of this area. The first one is the case management enrollment. This is an entry-level eligibility evaluation and coordination service available to all individuals determined to have intellectual and developmental disabilities, regardless of income level. In 17-19, the case management biennial average caseload is projected to increase to 28,218, or by about 11.5%. Enrollment is projected to grow rapidly until most people with intellectual or developmental disabilities have enrolled. Research is currently underway to determine what might be the natural limit where the caseload plateaus. We don't have good details on how many people with intellectual or developmental disabilities are out there in the state, and so we're waiting for that point to plateau of our caseload to plateau in these areas. The comprehensive in-home...
I just want to make sure I heard you right. So right now the growth in the next biennium is supposed to be about 11.5% in the case management enrollment.
That's correct.
And then just the other one quick follow-up is in the long-term care community and the in-home care, what's the growth rate expected to be, and are there any plateaus? I don't anticipate plateaus given the our demographics, but what are the projected growth rate there, percent-wise?
Co-Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, thank you for the question. I don't have those numbers off the top of my head and didn't prepare them in this presentation. I can get those numbers to you, though.
Okay. That would be very helpful. Yeah.
Long the short of it, they're all very scary numbers.
Yeah.
Yeah, none of them at this for the adult and people with disabilities forecast. Overall, we don't anticipate there being a plateau anytime soon with the case, the older population anticipated to double between now and 2030.
And I guess, Madam Co-Chair, My general concern is that if the growth rates and the cost of the growth rates is greater than our expected growth rate of revenue, right, long term, obviously that is a serious concern.
I think demographics would suggest that we'll start to see a plateauing in the aging of people with disabilities forecast. To some extent, we know that we saw a significant we're seeing a significant increase now because of us baby boomers getting older, which I think, Senator Winters, you and I are the only two on this panel.
Glad I'm among the baby boomers.
Are you?
Yes.
That's what I thought.
I'm a baby.
We'll start to see a plateau based on demographics because we know that Generation X is definitely smaller But that's not going to happen. I mean, I'm at the tail end of the baby boom, and I got a while before I get to that level. So, Representative Malmstrom?
One of the things I've wondered about is, coming from my background, we've been saving a lot of little babies, you know, that would have, in generations before, perished, you know, from being premature, other, you know, difficulties, that are now surviving, but they're surviving with disabilities. How much is that a part of all this as well?
It's a part. I mean, I think it's a little bit hard to know, but yeah. I mean, certainly in the 30 years I've been a physician, we've seen substantial improvement in our ability to save babies born at an early age, sometimes without any difficulties at all, and sometimes with significant disabilities down the road. I mean, it's great that we're offering them this opportunity and offering parents that opportunity, but it definitely changes what it looks like for some of our IED population.
Well, also, those are children that start as children and have disabilities their whole life versus somebody who is elderly and starts to have disabilities.
Right. You know? Exactly. Senator Gelser and then Senator Wiersbe.
And I would just add, I know nobody's saying anything different, but the quality of life of these individuals can't be measured by their disability.
Oh,
I know nobody's
right.
saying that. So
no.
it's really important to put that on the record that these are great things and a great lifetime.
That's why
even
I
with
was careful to
significant
say the word.
Disability. Yeah, I heard it just always important to put it,
absolutely.
Put it out there.
But I think when we think about trends in our population, just as I was thinking about the demographics of how many baby boomers there are versus Gen X, and then it goes up again with the millennials, Representative Malmstrom pointed out that medical advances
Absolutely.
Have allowed more children to survive into adulthood, which is a good thing, and it changes what we pay for. So, Senator Winters?
No, I don't have anything to add except that, you know, one, we're living longer, and two, even though we've done a lot medically with respect to the births and those qualities, we're still working on the other qualities of life. And the body actually begins to morph and take on different kinds of disease.
Yeah.
I remember it's not a bad thing. It's on. It's the disease. And so, you know, the chronologically advantaged group comes along with multiple kinds of issues. Just saying.
You want to expand on those issues?
Well, no.
All right. Let's let the gentleman the guy
win
his table. Keep moving.
Well, Chairs, members of the committee, I would just add to the adults and people with disabilities forecast that this is also about the financial situation of each person in this caseload. And it will greatly be swayed by how much resources folks coming into the program have in the future, not just the aging demographic.
Chair, I need to add another piece to, we talked the population trends and what's occurring. You know, I think that we have opened up the door, which that door wasn't open if I look back in time historically for my generation and others, where you still had the family. We weren't as transitory across this country and other places. We didn't move as much. And so families actually did a lot of what we're having to do today. I need to put that there, because now you have in the population where families actually became the caretaker and what have you, because they were all still living in one city or town or whatever. That is no longer true. That also lends itself to increasing the numbers as we age. And
although I just heard a report that says that's changing again. But anyway, Representative Buehler.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. So how do you explain the persistent changes in long-term care and in-home care population since mid-July of 13, after 4 years of stable enrollment?
Co-chairs, Representative Buehler, my best answer to that question is that there's been a specific movement to try to serve more of the population in-home than in facilities. Beyond that, I would have to get more information from the program.
But part of it has to do with the ongoing enrollment of people due to the K-plan and changes in eligibility and things like that, too, which happened back in right around there.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Something happened there in mid-July of 13. Okay. So either a new program or new emphasis.
It was the K plan. It was the K plan.
Okay. You see a decrease in the community-based care by quite a bit, and then you see the increase in in-home care.
Yeah. Right. We also see a decrease in nursing facilities. I think in general the trends are good ones, right?
Yes,
we're trending
yes.
people in the right direction out of community-based care into in-home care and out of nursing facilities into long-term care. So we're decreasing acuity, but increasing the population of people served at the same time that us baby boomers are getting old. Yes.
I think the same trend and philosophy that we had when we started in Oregon was unique and the only one that had Project Independence. And that started with, looking at graduated care, that, as much as we could to keep individuals inside of their own home. And that's true when this started with the adult and the people with disabilities population. So those trend lines actually reflect the change in policy.
Right. Okay, folks, we have about 20 minutes left, 25 minutes left, and I want to make sure OHA gets its shot. So let's rock
continue. In the interest of time, the comprehensive in-home services for adults and the in-home supports for children have also grown significantly since the K-Plan was open, and are also cost drivers that will be seen in 17-19. The child welfare forecasts are essentially flat. You see a slight tick down in adoption assistance. Exits from adoption assistance generally due to a child turning 18, at which point the subsidy ends, have increased following the fall 2016 forecast, causing the caseload to decrease more than expected. The child in-home caseload also experienced a large drop following the fall 2016 forecast. This may have been due to a shift in prioritization of traditional child protective service work. Out-of-home care has also been growing since the end of 2015, and again, this may be due to the shift in prioritization to traditional child protective service work. TANF and SNAP caseloads, as we have discussed earlier, have been dropping steadily since the recession ended. TANF caseloads are influenced by the economy and an increased focus on case management of TANF cases. SNAP cases are projected to drop more quickly than anticipated in prior forecasts based on recent trends. This is a sign of a better economy, though there are still 1 in 5 Oregonians on SNAP. Or the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. And finally, the vocational rehabilitation forecast. This reflects continued steady growth, but at a reduced level from the prior forecast. The former forecast reflected the increased number of people with intellectual or developmental disabilities that we were expecting based on the Lane versus Brown settlement. However, when forecasting started to do forecasts by disability grouping, it was shown that despite the increase in the people with intellectual or developmental disabilities population, we were seeing less growth in psychological, other mental health, mental impairments, deafness, and blindness. There has also been a slightly lower number of applicants than projected in earlier forecasts. And finally, clients are moving through application and eligibility quicker. We expect these trends to continue, so the number going into plan, where the majority of dollars are spent, will continue to trend upwards, but at the slower rate than projected in earlier forecasts. With that,
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Moore and Mr. Psyche? Thank you very much, gentlemen. All right, back to the OHA dynamic duo.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Kate Nass. I'm the Deputy Director of Finance with Oregon Health Authority. And I'll let John Collins introduce himself.
Okay. Sorry. Different dynamic duo.
You get a different duo.
I apologize.
Different duo.
I don't know if we're as dynamic, but we're here.
You're dynamic. Go for it. I apologize, Ms. Nass.
Thank you. And for the record, my name is John Collins. I'm the Director of Health Analytics for OHA.
And so we're here. We're going to talk about the Medicaid forecast. So that's our Oregon Health Plan. I know it's referred to as different names, so I just want to make sure that's clear. This is showing kind of the overall slide for the overall Medicaid caseload that we're looking at. Just to kind of orient you to the slide, the solid line is what we've actually experienced. So, excuse me, it does go back to January of 2012, so it does show that that big increase with the ACA expansion, and then kind of the experience that we've had since expanding. We have the like kind of orange dotted line would be the fall forecast, and that was what was used in the governor's budget. The blue dotted line would be the most recent forecast. And then those little red buttons or dots or diamonds are what's looking like the preliminary estimates. Oh, thank you. Appreciate it. That's looking like that's the preliminary estimates so far since releasing the forecast. So those are not final, those are preliminary. It's important to note that things change. You had a little bit of a conversation about retro eligibility earlier on, and so we always note these as preliminary estimates, not final actual. So just as a heads up. Excuse me, thank you. So this is just a chart showing what the biennial average looks like for the 17-19 biennium by each of our major caseload categories, and the changes by each what we call eligibility categories. And I feel like it goes a little bit to a question that Senator Steiner Hayward had earlier about where people are moving and going, and there is a lot of dynamics happening as we're going through our eligibility redetermination and renewal process over the last year. As we've renewed people, they have either moved off or onto other caseloads. And as well, at the same time, we've gotten a completely new people. And so I just kind of want to note that there's a large dynamic. Each of these caseloads has a dynamic population, and then the overall, it can change month to month depending on somebody if they're up for renewal or if they make a change or notify us of a change in household, a change in income, anything like that. So that changes every month. I feel like that's important. This is looking at a biennial average for the 17-19, so you can see that we are seeing that we are projecting a little bit of a decrease of about a little less than 5% on the AC adult population. The other two that I want to note is two down is the Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP, and Children's Medicaid. That's a population, like we talked about earlier, it's the same age group, it's just whether or not you fall under Children's Medicaid or CHIP is based on your income.
Ms. Nass, one quick question that you probably won't be able to answer. I'm struck by the decrease in pregnant women, and I'm curious whether anybody in the department has a sense about whether that's because our birth rate in the entire population is dropping, which would be a sign that we're doing a better job of getting people on contraception and decreasing unplanned pregnancies, or it's because the same number of people are having babies and they're just moving off of Medicaid because of improved financial circumstances. And so I'm kind of curious, somebody from Vital Stats may be able to help answer that question or something, but I hope the answer is our overall birth rate's dropping because people are getting better contraception, but and our unplanned pregnancy rate's dropping. But it could be that we're just seeing a decrease and people are moving off of OHP.
Senator Steiner Hayward, excellent question. We'll get you the vital stats. That's easy. That's something we can get. But a lot of it actually does have to do with our renewal and redetermination efforts and getting people in the right caseload categories.
Thank you. Senator Winters.
Thank you. Quick question. Will the redetermination numbers that should be completed by August 31, what impact will that have on these averages?
Co-chair,
you might
Senator,
ask something
yeah,
like that.
I was anticipating this question, Senator Winters. So, what happens when we do the caseload forecast? Is we look at the entire population, regardless of whether they're part of the what we're calling the $115,000 that we've been discussing over the last couple of weeks. So when we did the forecast, we included all million people, regardless of the $115,000 or the $900,000+. It's the whole amount of the caseload, and we forecasted them to renew on a renewal rate and incorporated the appropriate forecasted renewal rate for those each individual caseloads. So the $115,000 is included in our caseload forecast. It's part of our forecasting process to look at the entire population, not necessarily whether or not they fall in or out of that $115,000.
So because this is a budget committee, my second question, and it goes back to the process that we use now of quote, rebalancing and what have you, will the changes in that $115,000 become a part of any future rebalance?
So, co-chairs and Senator Winters, a good question. Again, the overall caseload forecast will be part of a future rebalance. And how those actually get renewed and redetermined will be part of our actual rebalance and a new caseload forecast.
Just needed to put it on the record. Thank you.
Thank you. I had to get my nods from Janelle.
Thank you. Representative Hayden.
Going back to the pregnant women, my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, which happens often, the Cowan population is a separate population for the pregnant women, not included, correct?
Co-chair and Representative Hayden, correct.
And if that was compared to this, do we see an increase there? Is that shifting?
We saw that number on the earlier presentation. It's down.
It's down also.
Yeah, Cowan's down also. Not by quite as big a percentage, but it's down also.
And
I noticed that on the previous presentation.
And Representative Hayden, we can get you the specific Cowan prenatal caseload. That's a separate that I did not include in this, but we can get you the details on it.
Quick follow up. If you could just explain, the Children's Medicaid is decreasing significantly. In DHS, it was increasing. There's not a correlation there.
Thank you. Co-chairs, Representative Hayden, when you mean Children's Medicaid DHS, do you mean child welfare? I just want to clarify before I answer.
Yes, it just seems like those. I see the CHIP program's going up. The Children's Medicaid is decreasing. On DHS, child welfare caseload is increasing. It seemed to be going in. Seems to me that they would be tied together.
We don't expect those to be tied together, the child welfare and the children's Medicaid programs. The children's Medicaid programs are income eligible and not related to a child welfare experience. So that what we're seeing in the children's Medicaid, you're kind of stealing my thunder for something later in the presentation, which is we're seeing people or children moving out of the children's Medicaid program into the CHIP program, which means the children's Medicaid program is income up to about 133 or 138% of FPL, whereas CHIP is covered from that point up to 300. So we're seeing children moving and exiting out of children's Medicaid and into the CHIP program.
And Representative Hayden, the previous presentation that OHA did showed the Cowan prenatal caseload at the fall 2016 forecast for the 15-17 biennium, which is a little bit confusing, but was 2168, and now their forecast for this biennium is 2120. So it's dropping by 2.83% instead of 3.5%. So it's analogous.
I will pay more attention.
No, you don't have to. I think it's a good question. I just wanted to make sure I pulled it up for you.
Okay. Well, that makes sense to me. So, okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
No problem.
I think it's in here.
Go ahead.
I think so, too.
So I just wanted to show a couple of graphical, like going down a little bit more into a couple of those caseloads. One is the ACA adults. I know this is one that we're monitoring closely. So we are still projecting to see a little bit of a decrease from what we had been projecting or forecasting from the fall forecast. We are watching this as we see renewal rates. So I just want to let this, one of the major risks around this ACA adult population is we don't know because ever since we've expanded, we haven't seen a normal renewal rate for this population because it's a whole new population and we're just getting through our technical issues. And so we haven't done a normal 12-month renewal process for the entire population. So we're still really watching their renewal rates, retention rates, exit patterns, and whatnot for this population, but projecting the best we can. This is the rest of the OHP population. This is showing everything but ACA adults. So this, when you look at this one, it's a little bit more flat, but we are projecting it to be a little bit lower in aggregate across the 17-19 time. Parent caretaker.
So actually, can I just ask you a question with that? I asked a question earlier about redetermination, moving people from ACA to pre-ACA caseload, traditional caseload, however you want to define it. But it occurs to me that the trend that we're seeing with kids, where some of them are moving from Medicaid to CHIP, could also move some folks from the ACA tradition, from the pre-ACA or traditional Medicaid into ACA as well, right?
Senator Steiner,
by income eligibility?
So, yeah, if it's a purely income-based population, it could be. So
but
if
that's
as people coming out of the TANF or the parent caretaker relative get more income, they could move out of that population into the ACA.
But it's a relatively small percentage because most of the kids were already covered. It's just adults.
That
would be applicable.
That would be, yes.
And healthy adults, basically, as opposed to dual eligibles who are elderly and... Right, okay.
And Medicare eligible.
And Medicaid, and yeah, right. Okay, thank you.
Thanks. So parent caretaker relative, I wanted to show the this particular caseload is one that we're monitoring really closely, again, as we get back into a normal renewal cycle. This population is parents. It used to be known as the TANF medical population, so these are families that are very low income, usually below 40% of the FPL, so a lot of them are unemployed with children, but they have to be parents, so that's one caveat to what I just answered to your question earlier was in order to be an ACA expansion, you don't have to have children, but in this one, you have to be a parent. So I wanted to just kind of note that this has seen some volatility ever since ACA expansion as we're trying to get through and understanding how the different caseloads are interacting with each other and people are going and getting eligible for the right caseload category. So we're seeing this caseload get a little bit more right-sized, I think, over and projecting it out. But this is another one that we're going to want to watch closely.
Representative Hayden.
Just a quick question out of curiosity. Being a parent isn't necessarily caring for a child. Is there a look at that at all?
Thank you, Representative Hayden. This is really the caretaker, the guardian. This could include a caretaker relative, so parent / caretaker relative. So it could be a grandma or
whoever's
an aunt.
Whoever's actually taking care
of
the child.
Yes, it's whoever's right. Taking caretaker.
Caretaker. Thank
right.
You.
So, yes, that is taken into account. And here's a little bit of what we were talking about earlier around children's Medicaid. We are seeing a decrease over the course, or projecting a decrease over the course of the next 2 years. But we do, if you skip right down to the next slide, CHIP is going up. So this is where we're kind of seeing that dynamic. So I kind of alluded to that earlier.
Does our match rate change?
It does. Under the CHIP, we get an increased match rate with the enhanced match rate. Yeah, it's
right.
Better. It's a better match rate on the CHIP program than it is on the children's Medicaid.
So this is good news for
us. It's great news.
For both for the economy, size of the economy, and in terms of our budget.
Exactly.
I like good, double good news. Okay.
I love delivering it.
Good.
I'm not taking responsibility, though. And then, so I also wanted to go into a little bit more of the aid to the blind and disabled in our old age populations. These are not just income. They either have to be disabled or a certain age in order to qualify for these programs. And then we're seeing a little bit more. This is an existing population that we've been working with over the course of the last many years, well before ACA. expansion. So this is looking a little bit more right on track. So if you want to go down to old age assistance too. Again, we're projecting the increase, but we're pretty darn close. And then lastly, it's always important to highlight our risks. So we've talked a lot about over the last couple of weeks about renewal and redetermination efforts, and as we get through all of the reset of the last 20 from 2016 and into beginning part of 2017, we'll be monitoring our renewal rates, like the what that caseloads look like, what the dynamics between as people move in and out. And again, the entries, the completely new clients compared to those that are transitioning or transferring from one caseload category to another. So we watch that closely. It's also important to note federal policy changes and any state or program changes that could have an impact on the caseload. So this is based on current policy. This does not include any of the potential policy changes that are being discussed at myriad of many places that are happening right now. And then lastly, economy can drive our caseload quite a bit. So we've seen that over the course of the last few years. With that concludes my presentation.
Representative Bueller.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. With regards to the ACA population, can you tell me how many of the decrease are due to the redetermination versus just people naturally moving off of Medicaid because of improvements in the economy?
Chair Steiner Hayward, Representative Bueller, I don't know if I could tell you exactly how much is based on improved economy versus the redetermination effort. We can tell you how many have exited, how many have transferred to maybe another caseload category, but I can't tell you the why.
I'm not sure it's a true dichotomy, though, because redetermination, in most cases, if they're determined to be non-eligible, it's because their economic circumstances, because everybody who's on OHP was at one point determined to be eligible by economic circumstances. So if they're redetermined to be non-eligible, it's because their economic circumstances have changed.
Not necessarily, because it's economics and residency.
Residency, okay, fine. But that's I'd be curious to know that, but I'm guessing that's a pretty small.
And the one other dynamic that could happen is family dynamic changes.
Right.
So marriage splits, things like
right.
that. That'd be another thing.
Representative Hayden. Representative Bueller.
Yeah, can you get that information? Is that
possible?
Is the reason redetermination versus just change in the economy?
Chair, as Representative Bueller, one of the difficulties in supplying that information is the way that the data is coded for us to be able to split the hairs on this, because there's a number of reasons people end up dropping off besides just improving their economic situation. But we can go back and supply as much detail as we can based on the data that we have.
It's true. I mean, people could get married and marry someone who has health insurance and go on their partner's health insurance. Have another baby, which would change things or whatever. Okay. Representative Hayden, quick question.
Just comment, actually, but I can withdraw it. Quick comment. I've been working on this for 3 years, so I like to say it when I can. If we were able to get child care payments to these folks monthly, we could actually have a triple benefit with more kids in CHIP and monthly stability of child care benefit. So still plugging away at that.
And I've heard you say it for 3 years, and I appreciate it. I think it's a good idea.
We appreciate your hard work on it, Representative. I think it's a very good idea. Okay. Any other questions or comments from the committee? Ms. Byerly, you've been quiet at that end of the table. Anything you need to add?
Madam Co-Chair, all the questions have been asked and all the testimony provided.
Awesome. Thank you all very much for this. We appreciate it. I'm closing the informational meeting. Colleagues, I would remind you that tomorrow, Thursday, June 1st, we do not have an 8:30 meeting. We do have a 4:30 meeting. Really important for everybody to be here. This is our first hearing on the provider tax proposal. So I need people here. 4:30 tomorrow. Should be on your calendar. Everybody was notified. late last week, I believe.
Yes,
right,
it was. Ames?
So
I got it last week.
A.M.?
No,
PM.
No, even I'm not that masochistic.
Special meeting.
So 4:30 p.m. tomorrow here, not 8:30 a.m. Okay, Ms. Ames, anything else for the good of the order?
Just now that the notice requirements have changed, be watching for us to schedule committees and more bills. So it'll, we'll try to give you as much notice as possible, as best we can. But
I think you should be back to assuming that we're going to be meeting most days now, because we're starting to hear policy bills, and this committee will have a lot of them, I can guarantee you, and some of them quite substantive.
Madam Chair, members might want to alert their staff of the changes that are taking place now and how quickly the hour notice is on.
Yep.
So if you're not watching those alerts, you may miss, and we don't want you to miss any of the hearings.
All right. Anything else, ladies and gentlemen? Okay. We're adjourned. Thank you all.